Hello everybody and welcome to this week's edition of the Wallingford District Talking Newspaper. We're reading articles from the Wallingford Herald published on Wednesday, May the 20th, 2026. Our three readers this evening are Alec Hayton, Pat Hayton and Jill Davies. Copy is Pete Orton and producer is myself, Lawrence. In addition to the tracks from the Herald, at the end of the recording, you'll also find some choice tracks from the monthly magazines.
One local announcement. The sad death of Vivian Cousins, who passed away suddenly on the 26th of April. Her funeral service will be at South Oxfordshire Crem in Garford on the 28th of May at 2 p.m. Family flowers only, please, and donations to the Deep Vein Thrombosis Research at the British Heart Foundation. All donations can be sent care of Howard Chadwick Funeral Service, Benson Lane, Cromarsh, or made online at chadwicksfuneralservices.com. Hello, this is Alec. Pub finally reopens with new owners. An historic pub near Henley, once owned by the troubled comedian Russell Brand, has welcomed patrons again as it reopens under new owners after being closed for more than 6 years. The Crown Inn in Pizzle near Henley has finally invited customers back under the new ownership of John and Jane Bloomer. Grade 2 listed pub and roughly 500 years old, in Stoner Road is at the heart of the Chilterns and has served as a coaching inn since the 15th century. But that long history was briefly interrupted when it came into the hands of the comedian and actor Russell Brand in 2020 after he bought it. The place is now reopened and you can visit when you like.
World's first laughing gas breathalyzer being tested. Strict new breathalyzers able to detect the intoxicating presence of laughing gas are being tested by police in response to the deaths of three teenagers in a car crash in the county. The young friends were killed when they were passengers in a car that crashed into a tree near Marcham, Abingdon, in 2023. The 18-year-old driver was filmed inhaling laughing gas, nitrous oxide, behind the wheel just moments before the crash. Thomas Johnson was travelling at speeds of up to 100 miles an hour before his car hit a tree beside the A1415, killing passengers Ethan Goddard, Daniel Hancock, both 18, and Elliot Pullin, 17. Elliot's family have backed calls for a nitrous oxide breathalyzer to be rolled out nationwide. The device, believed to be the first of its kind in the world, is being tested by Thames Valley Police in a groundbreaking trial. If successful, this could lead to motorists being prosecuted for drug driving offences. Nitrous oxide, also known as NOS, is a Class C drug under the Misuse of Drugs Act 1971, and offenders could serve up to 2 years in prison for possessing it for unlawful use. Elliot's family welcomed the introduction of the new device, which could save lives on the road. They said, "As a family, we fully support the trial of NOS roadside breath test to come into force. Having lost our beloved Elliot due to the recklessness and dangerous actions of the driver, who we know was under the influence of NOS behind the wheel of his BMW, we fully support any positive action that can be taken against drivers to prevent more lives being lost on the road. The idea of people being under the influence of such substance is terrifying. We hope that this trial, along with the coverage from the media, acts as a positive deterrent for other drivers. Through our loss and devastation, we hope that this trial educates other drivers in a positive way, and those who may consider using NOS whilst driving see the risk and danger of doing so. It's quite simply never worth the risk. Act Acting Superintendent Emma Hart of the Joint Operations Roads Policing Unit of Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary and Thames Valley Police said, "There is currently no device available that can prove a driver inhale laughing gas, making prosecutions difficult. That is why our forces are leading this testing phase to break new ground and to prove these devices can help save lives on our roads. As a team, we are always looking for new ways to make our roads safer. Nitrous oxide is a growing issue, especially with young drivers who don't understand the harm it can cause. So when we saw the opportunity to test this new technology, we knew how important it could be towards these devices being rolled out across the country. It is an extremely important technological innovation, and we are at the forefront of this cutting-edge research for the benefit of all UK policing."
Hello, this is Jill. Softball and disco fun for half term. Families are being invited to enjoy a packed programme of free and affordable events. In South Oxfordshire, children and parents can enjoy a variety of activities during the May half term, including a softball and cricket day at Didcot Cricket Club, explorer navigation challenges in Watlington, and family fun swims at Better Leisure Centres. Councillor Georgina Heritage, Cabinet Member for Communities at South Oxfordshire District Council, said, "We're so pleased to be able to offer so many half-term activities and shows. They are perfect for families and there really is something for everyone to enjoy together. It's also exciting to see Riverside gearing up for another summer of fun for families and outdoor swimmers. Make sure you book your place and get involved. Cornerstone Arts Centre in Didcot will host its Dinky Disco for children aged 10 and under. The programme also includes family fun swims at Better Leisure Centres, and the Riverside Park and Pools in Wallingford will reopen on Saturday, May the 23rd in time for the break. Details about the activities are available on the Leisure Centres Facebook pages, the Better UK website and app. The activities are expected to be popular and early booking is recommended at southandvale.gov.uk/holiday activities.
A thug to pay more than £1,500 after an attack. A thug has been spared jail after an attack in Didcot last year. Matthew Chomin of Crossroads Cholsey was sentenced at Oxford Crown Court on Thursday last week. The 32-year-old was charged with one account of assault causing actual bodily harm to a man in Didcot on October the 22nd last year. Chomin was handed a 12-month prison sentence suspended for 18 months. He was ordered to complete 12 rehabilitation activity requirement days, 200 hours of unpaid work within a year, and prohibited activity requirement for 12 months. Chomin was also given a restraining order of not to contact the victim for 5 years. He must also now pay compensation of £1,500 and a victim surcharge of £187.
Stores close due to critical error. Waitrose supermarkets across Oxfordshire were temporarily closed on Friday due to a critical error. Supermarket bosses opened some branches across the country late on Friday morning due to a national issue with electronic systems understood to be at the tills. Branches that were affected in Oxfordshire, which were due to open at 7 a.m, including Abingdon, Wallingford, Oxford Peartree Interchange and Wheatley. Other supermarkets across Oxfordshire that were due to open at 8 did so on time.
New mayor to pursue progress on projects. A new mayor of Wallingford has promised to pursue progress for long-running town projects. Town Councillor Nigel Hughes was sworn in on May the 12th, taking over the reins from Ros Lester, with Mark Hoskins as Deputy Mayor. The mayor-making ceremony at the Town Hall involved both the incoming and outgoing mayors and was attended by local dignitaries, former mayors and other town councillors. Having served in office for the municipal year since last May, Mrs. Lester thanked those who had supported her throughout her year in office, including Deputy Mayor Christine Sandel. The new mayor gave a speech thanking Mrs. Lester for her service and paid tribute to the Town Council and its past members for its strong tradition of public service. Looking ahead to the year ahead, the mayor highlighted a number of key priorities for the council, including progressing the Bullcroft Play Park project, finding a realistic path forward for the Regal Centre, and supporting much-needed renovations to the historic Town Hall to ensure it continues to serve the community for generations to come. And the article is accompanied by a colour photograph of Councillor Nigel Hughes and Ros Lester in the Town Hall.
Beach reopens amid sewage scepticism. Swimmers in Wallingford have voiced concern over sewage in the River Thames as the town's bathing place reopens for the summer season. Wallingford Beach, known locally as Sandy Bay, due to the stretch of sand on the riverbank next to Wallingford Bridge, was designated as a bathing place in 2024. This means the Environment Agency must take weekly water samples from the site during the warmer months from May the 15th to September the 10th and test them for types of bacteria which can cause serious illness. The results are published within a few days of each test on a dedicated page online, but many have said they wouldn't go for a splash even with the bacteria levels being monitored. Wallingford Beach is just one of two inland bathing sites in the country to be rated sufficient last year, an improvement on its first ever rating of poor in 2024. But would-be river users are not impressed by the rating. An anonymous local commented, "Seriously, we need to clean up the rivers. How can a council have a bathing area on the Thames, which is basically an open sewer?" It comes after the Channel 4 documentary Dirty Business revealed the scale of sewage pollution in waterways in Oxfordshire, based on the work of the campaign group Windrush Against Sewage Pollution. The county councillor for Wallingford, James Barlow, said while he still swam, it was disgraceful that measures had to be taken to avoid him getting ill. Mr. Barlow said there are many stretches of the Thames that are clean enough for bathing. For us in Wallingford, bathing water status offers not just regular testing, but also the legal mechanisms to force Thames Water to clean up its act to make Wallingford Beach consistently clean enough to swim in. For example, by installing further treatment operations at Benson Sewage Works, which would likely lead to improvements. Along with others, I've been regularly and safely swimming in the Thames at Wallingford year-round for years and continue to do so. I understand residents' scepticism about swimming at Wallingford Beach. That the bathing water quality is officially only sufficient is a real cause for concern. The impact on nature, including humans, is unacceptable. A Thames Water spokesman said, "Last year, Wallingford Beach was rated sufficient in the bathing water quality report, one of only two inland bathing sites in the country to receive this designation. There are no storm overflows from Thames Water sites within 5 kilometres of Wallingford Beach during the last bathing season. We are always committed to seeing waterways thrive, but can't do it alone. Farming, industry, road runoff and increasing extreme weather also play a role in river health."
School building up for sale as pupils prepare for fresh sight. And there's a nice little picture of many small children with hard hats and yellow gilets on around a digger. A school building has been put up for sale as staff and pupils prepare to move to a new site. St Nicholas Church of England School in Wallingford has been listed as price on asking, with the site expected to become vacant in September as teachers and children move to larger premises. The 1.9-acre area has operated as a school since 1962, when planning permission for the buildings and the dedicated access road was granted. In 1969, consent was also secured for a proposed nursery school on the southern part of the grounds, now the grass play area, which was never constructed. However, early years provision was later incorporated within the 170-pupil school itself, and from September it will be teaching reception year one, year two, and year three pupils. In the future, the school, which cites its Christian ethos on its website, will also accept children up to year six as it moves to a larger site on the Highcroft housing development. The school said, "We will be moving to a new school site on the Highcroft housing development and are scheduled to open in September 2026. The move will enable us to extend our age range and we will grow to become a full primary school for the Wallingford community." Since 1969, the building on St Nicholas Road has seen only minor school-related planning activity, including permissions for temporary classroom buildings and lightweight canopy structures. The listing states, importantly, no major development proposals have been brought forward, leaving the site largely unchanged and offering a rare opportunity for fresh visions to be realised. The existing school buildings extend to approximately 1,200 square metres of single-storey accommodation, including a canopy area. The layout provides a well-balanced mix of classroom, administrative and support spaces, making the site highly adaptable for a range of future uses. The Highcroft housing development is being built near the Wantage Road by developers Barclay. It will contain 555 homes, and last year there was a groundbreaking ceremony for the school, which saw demonstrations for pupils about the construction process. Head teacher Amy King said at the time, "The plan for the new school has been in development for a long time, and so it's really exciting to see it start to take shape and to have had so much involvement in planning what will be on offer for the children."
MP calls for quick rollout of vaccine for meningitis. An MP has voiced calls for a widespread vaccine rollout after the death of an Oxfordshire student from meningitis. Henley College student Lewis Waters was one of three students who caught meningitis in an outbreak in Reading. It was confirmed on Thursday of last week that the college student died from the disease, with a tribute from his father, Sean Waters, saying, "Words simply can't describe the heartbreak and upset we're going through." It emerged that the other two patients being treated for meningitis are pupils at separate schools in the area, Reading Bluecoat School and High Down Secondary School and Sixth Form Centre. The UKHSA said close contacts have been offered antibiotics as a precaution. A statement from Henley College said its thoughts and sincere condolences are with the student's family and friends at this extremely difficult time. We are supporting those affected within our college community and are following the advice and guidelines given by the UK Health Security Agency, it added. The MenB vaccine has been offered routinely to babies as part of the NHS Childhood Vaccination Programme since 2015, but anyone born before then will not be protected. Freddie Van Mierlo, Liberal Democrat MP for Henley and Thame, is now calling on the government to explore the possibility of a wider catch-up vaccination programme. He told the Press Association, "Naturally, there's worry in the community given what happened in Kent very recently, but as of yet, all the advice from the medical authorities is that this is contained and that we should continue as normal, and so people are continuing about as normal as they should. I think what we need to now look at, given what happened in Kent and now here in Henley, is a wider catch-up vaccination programme. We have a cohort of young adults at university and at colleges like this who've never been vaccinated against meningitis B, who I think now need to be protected. That's very clear. So what I'm asking the government to do is to look at procuring a large number of vaccines and rolling that out as soon as possible. Dr. Rachel Merkel, consultant in health protection at the UK HSA, said, "We understand that many people will be affected by this sad news and would like to offer our condolences to the friends and family of this student. Students and staff will naturally be feeling worried about the likelihood of further cases. However, meningitis requires a very close contact to spread, and large outbreaks, as we saw in Kent recently, are thankfully rare." The agency also confirmed that tests show the infection is not the same strain of meningitis B linked to a fatal outbreak in Kent in March. The UK HSA said that information has been shared with the parents and students at all affected schools about the signs of meningitis.
Wallingford Garden among the best of the best in UK. A Wallingford gardener is officially among the best of the best as ranked by the BBC Gardeners World magazine. Nadine Michunas is one of three people whose gardens are in the running for the Best of the Best edition of the Garden of the Year Awards. This year's competition, the 10th, has a unique twist. Every contender is a previous finalist, bringing together standout gardens from the last decade of the awards. Miss Michunas was nominated by the magazine's readers alongside Pam Woodall from Dorset, as well as Joe and Andy Butler from Shropshire. She was previously the 2021 Judges' Choice winner. Representing a broad range of gardening styles from across the country, each of the finalist gardens shows creativity, dedication, and a passion for plants. The overall winner will be chosen by a panel of expert judges to be announced in the October issue of BBC Gardeners World magazine. The panel includes the garden designer and BBC Gardeners World presenter Arit Anderson, garden designer and author Anne-Marie Powell, BBC Gardeners World magazine contact director Kevin Smith, and the head gardener Crocus, Ashley Edwards. Mr. Smith said, "Reaching the top three is a huge achievement, especially in this special anniversary year. These gardens truly represent the very best of the best from the past decade and showcase the creativity, dedication and passion of our readers. Choosing a winner from such an exceptional group will not be easy." BBC's Gardener World previous said about Miss Michunas' garden, "This really is a garden for our times, reflecting the care that so many gardeners have poured into creating spaces for wildlife to thrive. Our winner has achieved this to a high level of perfection, but not forgotten the need to make an atmospheric space to simply live in and enjoy. With mostly plants rather than landscaping used to create the space, it is a thrifty and achievable blueprint for many to follow."
Extended Biffa bin collection contracts. Two district councils in Oxfordshire have agreed to extend Biffa bin collection contracts, which they say will continue the same great service going forward. South Oxfordshire and Vale of Whitehorse district councils announced that their shared contract with Biffa has been extended beyond June 2026. The waste collection and street cleaning contract with the company has run for 16 years in South Oxfordshire and 15 years in Vale of Whitehorse. The councils jointly said theirs is one of the country's most successful residential waste collection services and has kept the districts in the top 10 of the English recycling tables for more than a decade. No major changes are proposed to bin collections or waste services with the extension of the long-running contract. Councillor Sue Cooper, South Oxfordshire District Council's Cabinet Member for Environment, said, "Our waste partnership has been successful over the last 16 years, and I'm proud of the fact that it has played a big role in setting us among the top recycling areas in the country, which is also thanks to the great effort made by our residents. I'd like to congratulate BIFA for coming out of the robust procurement process as the preferred contractor."
Ofwat consultation into reservoir project opens. A consultation has been launched by the Water Watchdog on the new Abingdon Reservoir, as it asks whether Thames Water can deliver the huge project. Ofwat opened the consultation on whether the White Horse Reservoir should be designated a specified infrastructure project, and Thames Water issued with a preparatory works notice on April the 2nd. The proposed project, previously known as SESRO or Abingdon Reservoir, would involve the 10-year construction of a massive reservoir which could hold around 150 million cubic metres of water to supply the South East, built just 5 kilometres southwest of Abingdon. It would be one of the largest reservoirs built in the UK and has been proposed to combat water supply deficit of the seriously water-stressed region as designated by the Environment Agency. But it's proved controversial, with Campaigners Group Against Reservoir Development receiving backing from the community, local MPs and councillors. Specifying the project would give the Secretary of State or Ofwat the power to specify an infrastructure project for separate delivery and regulation, meaning it would not automatically be undertaken by Thames Water, but rather put out to tender for an independent third-party provider to deliver and finance the project. This specification can be issued for projects which are considered to be of a size and complexity that would threaten the undertakers, in this case Thames Water's, ability to provide service for its customers, and if the specification is likely to result in a better value for money. Ofwat concluded that if Thames Water were to deliver the project, there would be a material threat to the company's ability to provide water services to its customers. Factors including the cost of the reservoir, estimated between £5.5 billion and £7.5 billion, according to prices in 2022-23. Its scale as the single largest reservoir project ever undertaken in the UK, and the risks around construction and engineering were all cited as reasons for this conclusion. Similarly, Thames Water's ability to manage it while delivering the long-term transformation of its business over the next decade was also considered a factor, including the project should be specified. Once specified, Thames Water may still be required to undertake preparatory works, like conducting site surveys relating to heritage, environment, and other elements, arranging for electricity provision, diverting utilities, and undertaking highway works, preparing designs and planning applications for the project, and procuring the works. However, the water company would be prohibited from delivering the infrastructure project itself. The consultation will close on May the 14th, and independent Vale of White Horse councillor Sally Whiteman, née Powolotsky, urged people to submit their views. She said, "This is a hugely important stage in the process. Now is the time to put your views on record."
On this day, 1932, Amelia Earhart became the first woman to make a solo air crossing of the Atlantic. Last year, Conservative councillor Ray Connolly said he was heartbroken. His wife Lucy's appeal against her jail term for inciting racial hatred was dismissed, adding, "My wife paid a very high price for making a mistake, and today the court has shown her no mercy." Notable birthdays: Lynn Davis, the Olympic gold medalist, is 84. Greg Dyke, who was former director of the BBC, 79. Keith Fletcher, who was a cricket coach, is 82. Nick Hayward, a singer, 65. Owen Teal, an actor, is 65. And Cher, the actress and singer, is 80. And in history on this day, 1498, Vasco da Gama arrived in Calicut in southern India after discovering a route via the tip of South Africa. In 1506, Christopher Columbus, the explorer, died in Valladolid in Spain. In 1799, Honoré de Balzac, a French novelist who produced 85 novels in 20 years, was born in Tours. In 1840, York Minster was very damaged by fire. In 1867, the foundation stone of the Royal Albert Hall was laid. And in 1903, Kew Bridge over the Thames was opened by Edward VII. Its real name is King Edward VII Bridge. 1956, America dropped its first hydrogen bomb over Bikini Atoll in the Pacific. And in 1991, in the USSR, the government passed a new law allowing Soviet citizens to leave the country of their own free will.
Harking Back with Emma Brennan, and this article is accompanied by some pictures of people riding all together as small children in a wheelbarrow, and a picture of a space hopper and one of a hula hoop. Space hoppers, kites and hula hoops were our idea of fun, and Emma recalls the various playthings which kept her and her friends amused in the 1970s. Some family friends recently held a birthday party for their two-year-old and hired a bouncy castle. Let's just say it wasn't a cheap source of entertainment, but the kids undoubtedly enjoyed leaping around on it. It got me thinking back to the kind of items we had to amuse us outdoors when we were children in the 1970s. As was the case with most things in those days, they were largely cheap and made from plastic or fashioned from found components by our dad. We were very fortunate that he was way ahead of his time when it came to upcycling. Most importantly, our outdoor toys were simple and inexpensive, but required a measure of imagination in turn to turn them into a game. They also taught us that it takes perseverance to master a skill, not just watching a YouTube video. In terms of the shopboat items, I'm thinking of in particular of hula hoops, frisbees, kites, and those icons of the 1970s, the space hopper. If you were lucky, you might have owned a pair of adjustable roller skates. My sister had some, but I never managed to master the art of standing upright with wheels attached to my feet, let alone skating anywhere. Hula hoops were probably among the simplest of toys and provided hours of fun or frustration, depending on your tenacity. Personally, I never achieved a sustainable hip swirl for more than 10 seconds, so the hoop sank to my ankles with alarming speed. I gained more exercise from continually bending down and picking up the hoop than I ever did through spinning it around my person. Some of my friends, however, became so proficient that they could even manage tricks using two hoops at once. Despite my personal lack of dexterity with a giant plastic ring, I can see that it was a great and very cost-effective way to keep fit. No need to go to a gym if you owned a hula hoop. Kites required even more skill to keep them aloft, not least the ability to recognise if the weather was suitable for flying. If there was no wind, it was a non-starter. If it was too windy, the kite would either crash into the ground or, worse still, get blown into the treetops. We lost many a kite in the branches of some pretty large oaks and then spent several hours honing our skill with a cricket bat in a vain attempt to dislodge them from the foliage. There was no way my dad was scaling an oak tree to retrieve a bit of plastic, so many a kite remained up the tree till gravity and bad weather brought them back to earth long after they had become faded, tattered wrecks. One of the earliest recollections I have is of me and my sister making our own basic kites from paper tied from some string, although I can't imagine that these ever flew far. One of Dad's finest inventions was a go-kart made with a pram wheel at the front and back and with a hinged front wheel section attached to a rope to enable it to be steered round corners. The only downside was that someone had to push, and most of us were very quickly wearied of being the pusher. It was undoubtedly more fun being the go-kart driver, but somehow we managed to sort it out amicably between us, so we each had a go. It was sociable and taught us about sharing, plus it expended a good deal of energy to push the go-kart. Dad was renowned for making us swings, wooden plank seats suspended from a tree with rope, and these provided hours of fun getting us outdoors in the fresh air. There was one occasion when the rope had become frayed from years of wear and tear. My sister gave me a hard push and sent me flying off into the ether as the rope snapped, and I hit the ground with such a thud that I was temporarily winded. Once I'd regained my breath and composure, I laughed it off and started crazing Dad to put up the swing safely again. We were tough cookies in those days. It's also worth noting that before we had the go-kart, we were open to a ride round the garden in the wheelbarrow, as long as one of the grown-ups was pushing it. We never owned a space hopper, but one of my cousins did. Apart from the obvious potential hazards involved with bouncing around on a giant orange ball with a crazy face and horns for handles, my cousin added to the drama by chasing me in his space hopper. Worse still, he would convince me to lie on the ground while he attempted to bounce over the top, leaving me feeling like the non-glamorous assistant in a magic show. Space hoppers seemed like such a modern craze at the time, and I did think it would be good to own one so I could at least get my own back on my cousin. But even the undeniable talents of my father did not stretch to him making us a space hopper. Nowadays, children seem to prefer to spend their time sitting in front of a screen rather than getting out and making their own fun with the kind of basics we had at our disposal. I used to laugh when my grandparents trotted out that "in my day" comments about how lucky we are to have so many toys compared with them. Who would have thought that some 50 years plus layers later that I would be mind-boggled by the virtual world inhabited by so many children these days, and that there would be an original space hopper circa 1968 in the Victoria and Albert Museum? Did you own a space hopper, kite or frisbee when you were a child? Or like me, did you have homemade outdoor toys? Please write to me with your views, recollections and pictures relating to this topic at ebrennanhere@gmail.com.
And this is the Herald Sport page. And it's got a photograph of Team of the Week of Didcot Town U7 Greens. And there are some very charming children, seven of them, all in a line, all grinning. And the main article is, "The U's must fill gaps in transfer window." Oxford United's squad ahead of the summer has been confirmed, and there are some glaring holes to be filled. The U's confirmed their retained list last week with 10 players leaving the club after their contracts expire. Matt Bloomfield declared after the regular championship ended that the yellow squad is not in need of an overhaul. However, there are areas that need addressing in the summer transfer window. With only two first-team centre-backs on the books in Michael Hellick and Kieran Brown, the U's are in desperate need of depth in this position. Golding is the only other option, but the Academy graduate has not played higher than League Two level for a consistent period and was most recently on loan at Southend United in the National League. Hellick and Brown both offer Championship and League One experience and are a strong duo, but Oxford could do with two central defenders at least to provide cover and competition at the back. We recently suggested Cambridge United standout Kelland Watts as someone in the U's should target. The Yellows have four recognised left midfielders in Aidemo Emekahu, Gion Jinwu, Siriki Dembele and Ferdinand, yet only one on the opposite side in Stan Mills. Decisions must be made on the futures of Dembele and Ferdinand. The former has not featured for United since February the 3rd, and the latter in over a year. Whilst those on the left could do a job on the right if needed, a natural right midfielder should be an area Oxford look at this summer. Links to Wickham Wanderers wide man Fred Onyenemima have appeared in recent days, with his future up in the air amidst potential U's interest. Whilst Oxford do have two capable options, fans are not struck with much confidence up front heading into next season. Mark Harris has a decent record in League One. He scored 15 goals in his last third tier campaign when the Yellows were promoted, but only netted 9 across 2 Championship seasons with United. Nick Prilic is another, assuming Odonkor will move out on loan or permanently, but he is still somewhat of an unknown quantity after a lack of consistent minutes following his move from Italian side Cagliari. The Slovenian showed some good signs at times, but only managed 1 goal in 24 Championship games this season. There is a world where either option hits the ground running, but going into next term with 2 relatively untrustworthy picks feels too much of a risk. Bringing in a striker with a more recent proven goal-scoring record at the level would be a sensible move by the club.
Okay, that concludes our recording for this week. Thank you for listening. Remember to stay listening for the articles from our monthly magazines that follow this track. But for this week, thank you for listening from us and goodbye.
Goodbye.
This is from the Benson Bulletin, and it's written by the people who farm at Cromarsh Battle Farms. Drier weather meant we were able to carry out spring cereal planting, which consisted of barley across the farms. Some blocks of land were direct drilled into the overwinter stubble, while others had pig manure applied, which was cultivated in prior to planting. These crops are now up and growing and, say it quietly, could do with a bit of rain. The drier weather has also meant we've been able to get on with fertiliser applications, as well as early fungicide applications on the winter cereals, to help keep them clean through the early spring. During the growing season, our agronomist walks the fields weekly to keep check on if there are any diseases or pests that need to be controlled. Weather conditions play a big part in the spread of disease. We use both solid and liquid fertiliser, as well as organic fertiliser called digestate. This is the byproduct of the anaerobic digester just outside Benson, where the local curbside food waste collection is turned into electricity. Work has also started on the preparation of the stewardship plots around the farm. We will be re-establishing overwinter bird food plots a bit later in the year. We regularly have an external tester come to the farm to check all of our farm trailers and make sure that the brakes are working correctly, using a rolling road and software that analyses braking capacity. Now that the days are longer and people are enjoying being out in the countryside, we would like to remind people that we have areas on the farm that are managed for wildlife, and you can help the success of these by keeping to designated rights of way. This is a poem by Eliza Cook called Bluebells in the Shade. The choicest buds in Flora's train, let other fingers twine, let others snatch the damask rose or wreathe the eglantine. I'd leave the sunshine and parterre and seek the woodland glade to stretch me on the fragrant bed of bluebells in the shade. Let others cull the daffodil, the lily soft and fair, and deem the tulip's gaudy cup most beautiful and rare. But give to me, oh, give to me the coronal that's made of ruby orchid mingled with the bluebells from the shade. The sunflower and the peony, the poppy bright and gay, have no alluring charms for me. I'd fling them all away. Exotic bloom may fill the vase or grace the high-born maid, but sweeter far to me than all are bluebells in the shade. This is My Vision Oxfordshire, and it comes from the My Vision website. My Vision offers lots of activities and events in Oxfordshire to support visually impaired people in the county. From fundraising events, technology showcases, to theatre trips, we aim to provide a broad selection of activities that you can get involved in. We are always interested to hear from you and find out if there are other events that you would like to get involved in, whether you want to suggest an activity or would like to be a part of the fundraising committee. We would love to hear from you. info@myvision.org.uk. Wallingford Social Group. On the 18th of May, we will be meeting at the Wallingford Library from 10:30 to 12:30. This is a perfect opportunity to meet other visually impaired people, have some great conversations, and enjoy some hot drinks and snacks. We look forward to meeting you there. If you have any questions or concerns, you can contact us. And the phone number is 01865 725 595. And this is a message from Mark, our Chief Executive Officer. I am constantly inspired by the people we work with. Everyone has a unique story to tell and a perspective we can all learn from. At My Vision, this inspiration has helped us grow a wide range of community-based activities and peer support sessions. These groups provide valuable opportunities to meet others, share experiences, feel inspired, and connect with your local community. You can find out more about our clubs, activities, and green walks below. Our greatest strength as an organisation is our community. By working together, we can better tackle the challenges faced by blind and visually impaired people across Oxfordshire. This collective strength is reflected in our membership. While you do not need to be a member of My Vision to access support, membership plays a vital role in strengthening the charity and helping to shape the work we do. You can now become a My Vision member for as little as £3 a month, £20 a year, or with a £250 lifetime membership. We would love you to join us in our mission to ensure blind and visually impaired people in Oxfordshire can live independent, active, and fulfilling lives. Lastly, I want to congratulate you all. Together, in our winter appeal, we collectively raised £15,170. What an incredible achievement. Thank you. This money goes a long way in supporting and developing our work. Our very own Queen of Crime, Agatha Christie, died on the 12th of January 1976, 50 years ago. The team from Wallingford Museum and TWAS, the History Society, marked the day by placing a fresh flower tribute on her grave, alongside a similar one from Cholsey 1000+. Agatha Christie exhibits in the museum have been extended this year, and this includes a newly acquired letter from 1974 in which Agatha touchingly reveals her special love for her dogs, particularly Bingo and Treacle. The special Agatha Christie weekend is usually held in early September to precede the International Festival in Torquay, which celebrates the author's birthday on the 15th of September. This year, however, the local celebration will take place on the 22nd to the 24th of May. The museum will be offering its usual guided walks, and full details of other events in the town will follow soon. So keep the dates free. For full information, please visit wallingfordmuseum.org.uk. wallingford.co.uk.
Wallingford Emergency Food Bank is a registered charity to provide emergency food parcels to individuals and families in need. Founded in 2011 by churches together in the Wallingford area, the Emergency Food Bank has grown significantly over the years. Demand has risen to about 6,000 people a year. And if you want to contact them, they have a website, wallingfordfoodbank.org.uk.
And continuing with Round and About and its spotlight on May's community events and activities, the old watercress bed site at Ewelm is now a Chiltern Society heritage site and a small nature reserve. It's open from 2 to 4:30pm, last entry 4pm, on the first Sunday of the month to afford visitors tours or self-guided walks around the reserve. Information and a short film about past watercress production and a display of old photos, plus the opportunity, on a good day, to sit in the sun by one of the precious chalk streams with teas available. Admission is £5 per person for adults. Assistance dogs only, please. The next openings are just missed one on the 3rd of May, then the 7th of June, the 5th of July, the 2nd of August and the 6th of September. From October, the timings change for the winter months. The visitor centre is in the street, Ewelm, halfway between the Shepherd's Hut and the shop, OX 10 6HQ. If you'd like further information, please visit chilternsociety.org.uk.